Okay, welcome to the deep dive. You know how we operate here. We take all that complex, fascinating information and basically turn it into the essential stuff you need. No endless scrolling.
Exactly, just the core knowledge.
And today we are really strapping in because we're exploring the incredible, just foundational work of an artist who, well, she proved that being radically authentic could actually lead straight to the top. Commercially, I mean.
We're talking about Melissa Etheridge.
Melissa Etheridge, yeah. And it's more than just the music history, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We're tracing the journey of really an American icon, Melissa Lou Etheridge. Her decades-long career kind of shows this complete blurring of the lines between her personal life and her public persona.
Right. The health battles, the way her family came together, all the political stuff.
It all ended up right there in the lyrics, and
Yeah,
on the stage.
totally. So our material today, it pulls together what? Over 40 years of work?
Yeah, 16 studio albums, those multiple Grammys, even an Academy Award.
And decades as a really fiercely dedicated activist. It's quite the package.
And when you hear that sound, the sources describe it as confessional lyrics, pop-based folk rock, and those raspy, smoky vocals,
That
that
voice.
voice. You're hearing someone who just never seemed to compromise her grit for pop stardom.
That's a great way to put it. Now, for you listening, what's really key here is understanding the complexity of her music. It's easy to just say rock.
Way too easy.
Yeah.
Our sources actually place her sound across five distinct, though kind of intertwined genres.
Okay, let's hear them.
All right. Heartland rock, roots rock, folk rock, blues rock, and country rock.
Wow, that is a seriously wide musical footprint.
It really is.
Let's maybe zoom in on Heartland Rock for a second because that feels pretty central to her appeal, doesn't it? What does that mean exactly in her context?
Yeah, Heartland rock is crucial. Think of that sort of blue-collar, story-driven rock music. It focuses heavily on regional identity, the experiences of everyday Americans. It blends that rock energy, but with folk storytelling. Artists like Springsteen, John Mellencamp, Bob Seger, they kind of define that sound.
Gotcha. So for Etheridge.
For Etheridge, it meant her music just felt grounded, real, accessible. It wasn't Hollywood glamour, it was more like Kansas grit coming through an electric guitar and that really powerful voice.
That authentic kind of working class foundation, that must be part of why her music hits so many different people at once.
I think so, yeah. It allowed her appeal to cross different demographics.
So our mission today really is to give you, the listener, a shortcut, a way to grasp the full force of her cultural impact. How did she keep that raw edge, that stripped down sound she was famous for?
All selling millions of albums, like
Yeah,
six times platinum.
exactly. And at the same time, become this incredibly fierce public pioneer for social and political causes, especially LGBTQ plus rights. It feels like her career was built on a kind of strategic vulnerability.
That's a perfect phrase for it. And that vulnerability, it really became a soundtrack for some major cultural shifts. Her life literally became the message, didn't it?
Yeah. Often forcing the mainstream to deal with difficult or, groundbreaking social topics just by, well, listening to a great rock song.
Just by playing the radio.
Okay, so to really get the icon, we got to start back in the heartland. Let's trace those origins in, let's call it section two, the making of a rock star. This covers, say, 1982 to 1992, that foundational decade.
Right. Melissa Lou Etheridge, born in Leavenworth, Kansas, 1961. And you absolutely cannot understand her music without understanding those Midwestern roots.
It shaped everything.
Totally. The sources are clear. She started guitar lessons super young, like 8 years old.
Eight. Wow.
Yeah. But the biggest thing seems to have been her family environment.
And specifically her dad, John Etheridge. The sources point out this really fascinating dual role he played. Well, he was an American Constitution teacher at her high school, Leavenworth High.
Ah, okay. So she's getting this civic education, talk about rights, from day one.
Exactly. Which, looking back, feels like a pretty powerful predictor of her later political activism.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
But he wasn't just the teacher, right? The sources say he was also like her number one roadie.
Yeah. He bought her that first guitar. And the stories about her early gigs are just great because she was playing in local bars and clubs as a teenager.
Underage, yeah.
Totally underage. So the sources confirm he would literally go with her to the venues, sit there while she played.
That's incredible dedication.
Isn't it? It wasn't just supporting her dream. It kind of created the space where she could develop that raw stage presence that later became her signature.
Yeah, hone the craft without worrying about, getting kicked out.
Right. And that appreciation for her roots, for her dad's support, it clearly lasted.
Definitely. The sources mention that after her father passed away, I think it was 1992, she set up a performing arts scholarship at Leavenworth High in his name.
That's not just nostalgia. That's like putting your money where your heart is, reinvesting in the place that launched you.
Exactly. A real tangible connection back.
Okay. So the next step is the classic musician story, the leap of faith. She goes to the prestigious Berklee College of Music in Boston.
But not for long.
Nope. Just 3 semesters. Then she drops out, makes the big move to Los Angeles, tries to make it in music full time.
And this is where we get that famous discovery story. It's a great aha moment, really.
How did it happen again?
Well, her grit, basically. She was playing gigs wherever she could, like Vermi's Bar in Pasadena. But crucially, she was also playing the LA lesbian bar circuit, building a following, you know, grassroots style.
Right, playing to her community first.
Exactly. And the sources say her discovery came through a friend she made on a women's soccer team, Carla Leopold.
A soccer team? Seriously?
Yep. And Carla's husband, Bill Leopold, happened to be a music manager. Carla basically convinced Bill to come check out Melissa.
No way.
Yeah. And Bill Leopold became this absolutely pivotal manager in her career.
So a pickup soccer game directly leads to Grammys and platinum records. That's amazing.
That's a great story. And this connection, this management, eventually gets her noticed by Chris Blackwell.
The Chris Blackwell. Head of Island Records, the guy who launched U2, Bob Marley.
The very same. Mm-hmm. But that first interaction with Island Records, it tells you a lot about her whole career trajectory.
Just so.
Because the sources reveal that her very first attempt to record an album for Blackwell, it got rejected.
Rejected? Why?
He thought the recordings were too polished and glossy.
Wait, hang on. A major label boss told her she sounded too commercial. That's backwards.
Isn't it? But it forced her hand. She had to strip everything down, lean back into that heartland rock authenticity we were talking about.
Okay.
So the result was her self-titled debut, Melissa Etheridge, 1988. They recorded it super fast, like 4 days, just capturing that raw live energy.
That works.
It became an underground success. Peaked at number 22 on the Billboard 200.
Not bad for a stripped-down record.
And the first single, Bring Me Some Water, boom. Her first Grammy nomination right out of the gate, 1989. Best Rock Vocal Performance, female.
So she basically found the winning formula because her first attempt was too slick. Forced authenticity.
You could say that. Or maybe just guided back to her strengths. And she stuck with it. Her second album, Brave and Crazy in 89, followed that same formula. Stripped down, rootsy, same chart peak, number 22 again, and picked up 2 more Grammy nominations.
So he was building momentum.
Definitely. Building this really dedicated fan base by touring like crazy nonstop. People called it her Bruce Springsteen phase because she was just always on the road.
That hard work pays off. We see it culminating in her first actual Grammy win in 1992 for the album Never Enough.
Yes. That album peaked just slightly lower, number 21. But the lead single, Ain't It Heavy, that was the one. It won the Grammy for Best Rock Vocal Performance, female.
Her first win.
Her first win. And what's interesting here, looking back, is that during this whole period, there were constant rumors, whispers about her sexuality.
Right. She hadn't publicly come out yet.
Not yet. But that album, Never Enough, it felt so intensely personal. Critics and listeners kind of saw it as this powerful, really mature work that seemed to maybe implicitly address those whispers. It definitely set the stage for what came next.
Yeah, sounds like the pressure between her private reality and her public image was building, like something had to give.
Which brings us perfectly into the next phase, let's call it the identity and the breakthrough. This is that crucial period, roughly 1993 to 1995. This is where her career and her personal truth just collided.
Emerged, yeah, and caused this massive explosion into the mainstream.
You can actually pinpoint the exact moment this happened. January 1993, Melissa Etheridge publicly comes out as a lesbian.
And where she did it is key, right?
Oh, the setting is everything. It was at the Triangle Ball. Mm. This was a really high-profile event celebrating President Bill Clinton's first inauguration.
So not some quiet announcement. This was major. National stage, political event, celebrating what felt like a progressive shift.
Exactly. She was already a Grammy nominee, pretty successful. But doing it there, on that platform, it instantly elevated her. She went from rock star to, well, cultural pioneer overnight.
And it seems like the music world and maybe the wider culture was ready for it because what came next was just huge.
Huge is an understatement. Her next album, Yes I Am, came out just months later, September 93. So this wasn't just successful, it completely redefined her career.
The numbers you mentioned earlier are kind of mind-blowing.
They really are. Yes, I Am spent, get this, 138 weeks on the Billboard 200 chart.
That's over 2.5 years.
Incredible longevity. It peaked at number 15 and eventually got certified 6-day platinum by the RIA, 6 million copies.
Wow. And that's still her biggest seller by far.
By a long shot, yeah.
So what was it? Was it just the timing, the coming out, or did the music itself change? Because her earlier stuff, critically liked, but it barely cracked the top 20.
I think it was this really powerful synergy.
Yeah.
The music itself felt more confident, more openly celebratory of who she was.
Okay.
So you combine that authentic rock sound she already had with lyrics that could now be heard through this new lens, this confirmed identity. It just resonated incredibly deeply. The mainstream audience was ready for that honesty.
And it produced some monster hits.
Absolute radio behemoths. Two of them.
I'm the Only One. That was her only Billboard top 10 single ever, right? And number one on adult contemporary.
That's the one. And then, of course, Come to My Window.
The song that won her the second Grammy.
Yep. Another Grammy for Best Rock Vocal Performance, female. It really solidified her status. It's interesting, too. She got nominated for Best Rock Song for both of those hits.
It didn't win.
Lost both times to Springsteen's Streets of Philadelphia, which, you know, shows the level of competition. But more importantly, the success of Yes I Am had this ripple effect, boosting her entire back catalog.
Ah, right. People discovering her went back to the older stuff.
Exactly. Her debut album went double platinum in 95. Never Enough hit platinum status, too. All riding the massive wave created by Yes I Am.
That really is the sign of a cultural moment, isn't it? When the new stuff makes the old stuff new again.
Mm.
And she didn't waste any time using that newfound visibility for, well, direct political action.
No, she was completely fearless about it.
Mm.
Also in 1993, right after that breakthrough, she announced she was boycotting playing shows in Colorado.
Why Colorado?
It was a direct response to the state passing Amendment 2. This was a really controversial law that basically stopped local governments from protecting people based on sexual orientation.
Hang on, let's connect that back. Her dad taught the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah.
Her first big political move as a newly out icon is civil disobedience against a state law she saw as infringing on rights. That feels very consistent.
It absolutely grounds her actions, doesn't it?
Yeah.
She clearly saw it through that lens of fundamental rights being denied. A perspective, yeah, probably absorbed from her upbringing, her identity, her career. They were now completely intertwined advocacy tools. And she used them to challenge laws she saw as unjust.
So the follow-up album, Your Little Secret, 1995, it also did really well.
Extremely well. Though, as you noted, its chart life was shorter, like 41 weeks compared to that epic 138 for Yes I Am.
Still pretty good.
Oh, yeah. And it actually debuted higher on the chart, peaked at number 6 on the Billboard 200. That's still her highest charting album ever.
Okay, so she maintained the momentum.
Definitely. It produced 2 more top 40 hits, including I Want to Come Over. It basically confirmed, you know, she wasn't a one-hit wonder, or one-album wonder, I should say. She kept that commercial success going, solidifying her place as a mainstream rock powerhouse, whose identity was now just fully part of her art.
All right, moving forward. We get into this period that feels defined by just navigating the complexities of public life, family, health, activism. This is where her really groundbreaking approach to her personal life becomes this continuous, like, front page story.
Yeah, once she's secured her place as this public advocate through the music, she then had to figure out how to live that authenticity in the most intimate areas, her family, her health.
Starting with her long-term partnership with Julie Cypher, that began around 1990, lasted about a decade.
Right. And in the public eye at the time, that relationship, and especially how they built their family, was pretty revolutionary.
The public reaction must have been, well, intense, when they decided to have children using artificial insemination and then revealed the sperm donor was David Crosby, the musician David Crosby.
Oh, it was absolutely seismic. You have to remember the time, late 90s. This wasn't just some private family decision being shared. It felt like a very public statement about how the definition of family was changing.
Forcing people to grapple with it.
Exactly. Forcing the world to grapple with non-traditional family structures. Cypher gave birth to Bailey Jean in 97 and Beckett in 98. And because all three people involved, Etheridge, Cypher, Crosby, were celebrities, it put this very modern family dynamic under a massive global spotlight.
And like many relationships, it eventually ended around 2000. And true to form, her music became the place where she processed that.
Yeah, the 2001 album Skin. It's a really fascinating listen in that context. Critics called it a, quote, harrowing, clearly autobiographical dissection of a decaying relationship.
Wow, harrowing.
It reflected that intense emotional fallout. Critics actually appreciated the raw vulnerability. It got a decent score on Metacritic, like 73 out of 100.
But commercially?
Commercially, it was a tougher sell. Moved fewer than 500,000 copies. Maybe, you know, the audience found that kind of relentless honesty about relationship difficulties harder to digest than the triumphant honesty of, yes, I am.
Interesting point. After the breakup with Cypher, she started dating actress Tammy Lynn Michaels in 2002.
Right. They had a commitment ceremony in 2003. And their family grew again. Fraternal twins, Johnny Rose and Miller Steven, born in 2006. This time conceived via an anonymous sperm donor.
They were really committed to marriage equality too, weren't they?
Deeply. Sources confirm they actually planned to get legally married after the California Supreme Court overturned the state's ban on same-sex marriage back in 2008.
But sadly, that didn't happen for them.
No. They ended up separating in 2010. And unfortunately, that led to a very public, pretty messy 2-year legal battle over child support. It finally got settled in 2012. But it just highlighted again how every part of her family's life, legal, emotional, was subject to intense public scrutiny.
Yeah, the downside of that radical transparency, perhaps. But then we come to the chapter that really went beyond celebrity gossip and became this touchstone for health advocacy, her cancer battle.
This is where her public life really provided, I think, immense emotional connection and support for millions of people.
The diagnosis came in October 2004, breast cancer, followed by surgery, chemotherapy.
And the sources really emphasize her return to the stage, the 2005 Grammy Awards. It's not just an iconic Grammy moment. It's seen as this moment of profound cultural significance.
Let's paint that picture because it really was breathtaking. She was performing a tribute to Janis Joplin, right? With Joss Stone.
Exactly. Stone started with Crybaby, and then Melissa joined her for Piece of My Heart.
And the visual was just striking.
She performed completely bald from the chemo. Just standing there on stage, raw, exposed, but absolutely belting out this powerful rock song.
It was this incredible image of courage, vulnerability, resilience all at once, literally fighting for her life and choosing that song about radical emotional honesty.
Mm-hmm. The reaction from the audience in the room and then from the media afterwards was just immense.
And didn't that moment inspire another artist?
Yeah, the sources mentioned it was so powerful that India Airy wrote her song, I Am Not My Hair, specifically about watching Etheridge that night.
Yeah.
About her bravery.
Wow. So it turned this private health crisis into this shared experience, this undeniable act of health advocacy just by showing up.
Absolutely. And she continued that open approach. She brought the, you know, private details of her recovery into the public conversation, too. Like in a 2005 Dateline NBC interview, she talked openly about using medicinal marijuana during chemo.
To manage the symptoms, yeah.
Right, which back then was a pretty significant thing to say publicly, given all the stigma, the legal issues around medicinal cannabis use.
It put her right back in that role of pioneer advocate, even on potentially controversial health topics.
And her activism kept broadening. Beyond personal health, beyond LGBTQ plus rights, she moved into environmentalism, too.
Which led to another major career high point.
Right. She wrote and performed the song I Need to Wake Up for Al Gore's documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. That was 2006.
And that song won an Oscar, Academy Award for Best Original Song. That's a huge deal, bridging rock music and environmental awareness like that.
It really was. Showed her political engagement wasn't just about identity politics. It was a huge win, showcasing her reach. And she kept using that platform. Performed at the Live Earth concert in 2007, then at the Democratic National Convention in 2008.
And as we touched on earlier, when politics didn't go the way she hoped, she was willing to take a really radical stand. Like when California passed Proposition 8 in November 2008, banning same-sex marriage again.
She announced an act of civil disobedience, declared she would stop paying her state taxes in protest.
Which is not just symbolic. That has real potential legal and financial consequences.
Absolutely. It just reinforced that central theme of her career, didn't it? That absolute refusal to separate her personal beliefs from her public actions, even financial ones. For Melissa Etheridge, activism was life, and life was advocacy.
Okay, let's turn now to sort of the continuing journey, music, loss, and legacy. Covering her mid to late career, how things evolved after those really intense cultural moments of the mid-2000s. She kept evolving, right? both musically and how she engaged with her audience.
Oh yeah, she definitely kept pushing things artistically. Her 2014 album, This Is M.E., that's a really cool example of audience engagement.
How so?
The cover art, it's a mosaic.
Yeah.
Made up entirely of photos submitted by her fans.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Isn't it? And the title, This Is M.E., her initials, obviously. But the artwork makes it clear that the fans, the M.E., are intrinsically part of her story, her journey.
That's a really powerful way to acknowledge a fan base that had stuck with her through so much public drama.
Totally. A gesture of gratitude, shared ownership. And she also took time to really honor her musical roots again.
The Memphis album.
Exactly. 2016, Memphis Rock and Soul was a covers album, diving deep into that blues tradition. Tracks by legends like Otis Redding, William Bell.
It really reinforces that commitment to the blues and roots elements that were there from the start. Her sound didn't just lose its edge over time.
No, she kept returning to it. And what's also fascinating about her later career is the decision to kind of look backward artistically. The 2021 album, One Way Out, is a prime example.
Tell us about that one. It's newer material.
Well, yes and no. It's mostly songs she actually wrote way back in the late 80s and early 90s.
Stuff that didn't make the cut originally.
Pretty much. But she recorded them recently with her original band from that era. So it's almost like this time capsule she brought forward.
That's interesting, giving those early songs a new life.
Yeah, and the last two tracks are even live recordings from 2002.
Hmm.
It feels like an artist reviewing her whole journey, wanting to finally realize these songs that defined her earliest sound, but maybe with the perspective she has now.
She also branched out beyond just recording and touring, into theater.
Yeah, she dipped her toe into acting. In 2011, she took on the role of St. Jimmy, that sort of troubled punk character, in Green Day's Broadway musical American Idiot. Just for a week, but still.
Wow, that's a different look for her. Shows versatility.
Definitely. And maybe that experience kind of led towards the premiere of her own one-woman show on Broadway, Melissa Etheridge, My Window, which opened in 2023.
That feels like the ultimate step for such a confessional artist, turning her life story directly into theater, spoken word, music.
It's the ultimate expression of that transparency she's always embodied, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. The sources also track continued personal milestones, like after the Supreme Court finally ruled on gay marriage nationwide.
She married her partner, Linda Wallum, May 2014. Apparently it was just 2 days after they both turned 53.
A real moment of personal joy tied directly to decades of political struggle she'd been part of.
Absolutely. But we also have to touch on the fact that her very public approach to health advocacy, while often inspiring, sometimes led her into, well, controversy.
Right. There was that situation in 2013 regarding Angelina Jolie's preventative double mastectomy.
Yes. Jolie did that to reduce her cancer risk because of a specific gene mutation she carries, the BRCA gene. Etheridge attracted a lot of attention for her comments on that.
She called Jolie's choice fearful, I think. How did she explain that?
She basically stated her belief, based on her own cancer experience, that, quote, cancer comes from inside you. It's the stress that will turn that gene on or not.
Okay.
So she seemed to be implying a strong belief in the body's ability to resist disease based on managing emotions or stress rather than just genetics.
Which, you know, we have to report impartially here, but that definitely put her at odds with the established medical consensus, didn't it?
It did, immediately. Medical experts, including like the director of the Breast Health Resource Center at Mount Sinai Hospital, publicly criticized her remarks.
Yeah.
They cautioned that what she was saying wasn't factually accurate about genetics and cancer risk and could even be misleading about preventative medicine.
It really highlights that tricky line an iconic figure walks when they use personal experience as a platform. It can be incredibly powerful for connection and compassion.
But it can also lead to sharing views that medical professionals strongly contest. It's a complex legacy.
And this section of her life, unfortunately, concludes with just devastating loss in 2020. Another intensely personal tragedy that, again, she chose to share publicly.
Yes. The heartbreaking death of her son with Julie Cypher, Beckett Cypher. He was only 21.
And the cause?
The sources confirm he passed away due to issues related to opioid addiction. And again, true to her nature, she used her public platform, social media this time, to talk about that immense private grief. But also in doing so, drawing attention to the devastating opioid crisis that hits so many families.
Sharing the pain, hoping maybe to help others feel less alone in it.
Exactly. Despite all that immense personal turmoil, those very public challenges, the accolades and honors kept coming, recognizing the sheer endurance and impact of her career.
Yeah, the list is pretty impressive.
It really is. An honorary doctor of music from Berkeley in 2006, the ASCAP Founders Award in 2007, and, you know, cementing her place in Hollywood history, that star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 2011.
And going way back, VH1 ranked her pretty high on their list of greatest women in rock.
Yep, number 49 on VH1's 100 Greatest Women in Rock and Roll back in 1999.
Uh-huh.
Plus, consistent recognition from the LGBTQ plus community, she won the GLA8 Media Award for Outstanding Music Artist 3 times. 94, 95, and 2006.
Okay, so let's wrap this up. What does all this mean for you, the listener?
Mm.
We've traced this incredible journey, right, from those early Kansas bar gigs with her Constitution teaching dad supporting her,
all the way to the biggest stages in the world, and linking her music and her advocacy, really, at every single step.
What really stands out, I think, is how Etheridge became such an essential voice, not just in music, but in the cultural and political conversation. And it seems like it was because she consistently paired that deeply vulnerable songwriting with just extraordinary public bravery.
She never backed down, did she? Played lesbian bars when it was underground, came out publicly during a presidential inauguration, stood on the Grammy stage, bawled, fighting for her life, and sang her heart out.
And her success, particularly with Yes, I Am Hitting 6X Platinum, it really proved something important, didn't it? That radical authenticity could be commercially viable. That telling those stripped-down, confessional, sometimes really painful stories, people would buy it. Millions of people.
Yeah, she showed the mainstream audience, maybe before they even knew it themselves, that they were ready to embrace music that was emotionally native, politically courageous. She really carved out space for others to follow in her wake.
And her willingness to share just every complex chapter of her life. I mean, from creating that groundbreaking family with David Crosby as the donor,
to navigating very public partnerships and divorces, battling cancer so openly, getting into controversial territory with her health views.
And then facing the absolutely devastating public loss of her son to addiction, it established this kind of new benchmark for visibility, didn't it?
It really did.
Mm.
And she seemed to believe that visibility was crucial for changing the world. There's that quote from her about gay parents.
Right, she said. I think that the more gay parents raise good, strong, compassionate people, the better the world will be.
So if you connect that belief, that desire to generate compassion, with the sheer breadth of her own lived, shared experience, her life almost becomes this like living case study in human complexity.
Yeah. She made a life that defied easy categorization, defied traditional norms, utterly visible, and somehow relatable, refusing to let any part of it, the triumphs or the tragedies, be hidden away.
Mm.
Which brings us to a final thought for you to maybe mull over next time you listen to her music. Given everything she shared, the groundbreaking family stuff, the cancer battle, the controversies, the grief, how has that relentless willingness to put every single facet of her complex public life out there, how has that ultimately advanced the cause of maybe human compassion or even just critical thinking for listeners around the world?
It's a powerful question and a powerful legacy. It really proves that sometimes the biggest contribution an artist can make is simply by choosing to be completely unapologetically visible.